Hey everybody, this is Jason here with my buddy Martin to talk about, in honor of Black History Month, a book by Pastor Albert Tate, How We Love Matters. We really hope this episode is helpful to you guys. Let's get into it. Martin, say hi to everyone.
Well, hello, y'all.
God. I'm sorry. That was a bad one. What? Hello, y'all. Welcome, fellow kids. That had the same vibe.
I don't even know what that's from.
Anyways, I think it was an SNL skit. Greetings, fellow kids. Yeah, this is Martin. I'm Jason. Thank you guys for joining us today. Martin, you recently read a book by Pastor Albert Tate called How We Love Matters. You want to give us a real quick synopsis? What's the book about? What's kind of the general point of it? Why did he write it? And then we'll start getting into some questions.
Yeah. So, fair warning, have not finished the book. That's
Martin.
I know. Martin. There's a lot of things going on right now, but I love it so far. And Albert Tate is a, like Jason said, he's a preacher in California. But one of the things that I always think is really interesting is he's not at the big preaching and teaching conferences. More likely, he's going to be at some kind of conference that's going to focus on racial reconciliation. And that's kind of the topic of the book, is how do we as Christians approach this topic? Because as people, you know, there's one level of understanding, right? We're all people. We should consider ourselves equal. You know, that's fairly basic. But when we get into the Christian faith, right? Well, first of all, we're not just people. We were created in the image of God, no matter what color we are. And so that makes this a priority. Jesus talks about unity in the church and says, if you are not willing to be unified with other believers, no matter who they are, then you will be cut off from him. And that's a fairly serious threat in my mind. I mean, Albert Tate likes to talk about this topic a little bit more than some others. And he's a Black preacher. And if you have never listened to one of his sermons, please do. Because
he is an absolutely terrific communicator.
They are phenomenal. He is my favorite preacher in the world. And so when I saw this book on the shelves at Barnes & Noble, I think, in Des Moines, I said, I have to get this. Like, I've been waiting for this book. I love what he has to say. And for those of you that might be saying, some of you guys know me and Jason both, and you're saying, well, you're a couple of white guys. Why are you talking about this? This is something that's really close to my heart. For a lot of you guys, you may not know me very well. I have four stepbrothers on my dad's side, all four of which are Black. My best friend growing up was Black. My church that I served in while I was in college was not an African-American church. It was a Chinese church, primarily with first-generation immigrants. And so I've witnessed racism from the outside, and I want to share a little bit about what I've seen and what I've empathized with the people that I care about.
All right, Martin, so let's get into the content of this book or what you've gotten through so far. First of all, you mentioned to me that there's some information in here specifically about how we should lead multicultural or multi-ethnic churches. So churches that are not just white people, churches that are not just Black people, churches that are not just Chinese people, but that are all sorts of different backgrounds, even different language groups. So what kind of advice, what does Mr. Tate give concerning how to start working in that direction, how to lead and grow multicultural churches?
Yeah. So one of the things that he talked about towards the beginning of the book was what it means to lead a multicultural church. Because a lot of us will say we attend multicultural churches, or we are a part of, and multi-generational is going to be the same way. We're a part of a multi-generational church, but your leadership isn't going to reflect that, right? So, for instance, my church is four elders, and there's 120 of us. Our four elders, which includes me, 75% of them are above the age of 55. All four of us are white. And really, the two that are not on staff are retired and near retirement. I mean, they are the same generation, at least very close, right? And so I'm going to talk a little bit about multi-generational churches first. When you start talking about wanting to be a multi-generational church, that means that you have to have people who are multi-generational in leadership. You have to have a team that is not people just throwing out ideas about what the new generation wants, because that's how you get churches that spend 10 grand on a coffee bar and no outreach. That's how you get churches that, you know, add another position so that someone can create TikToks for your church, but you still don't know how to talk to a millennial. That's how you get churches that have no idea what they're doing and just start throwing money at problems. And frankly, it's a really dangerous place to be in. So it's important to have somebody who is a part of the group that you are reaching. And that's just a general leadership principle, right, Jason?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the objection that you'll get sometimes to, okay, well, fine, we know that we need to get younger, or we know that we need to reach out to people in our community that are not the same ethnicity as us. They'll say, but we don't have anyone in that group that fits the qualifications for an elder in our congregation. We don't have any, like, how do we reach out to people who are African-American when we only have one African-American person in our church and they're not qualified to be an elder? And my response to that would be, they don't have to be an elder for you to listen to what they have to say. So if they're an insightful person and they want to help the church, then why don't you just sit down and say, hey, I'm sure you've noticed that your family is the only Black family in our church, and that doesn't represent our community well. Have you noticed anything we're not doing right that we can maybe change to try to help? Or you can even, if you're big enough and have the money to, you can think about that when you're hiring. You can think, man, we have a big African-American population. We have a big Hispanic population, but we don't have anyone on staff that's Black. We don't have anyone on staff that speaks Spanish. So how can we hire to move into that? So there are solutions without making someone an elder.
Absolutely.
You know?
And so, and that's part of what my church was really excited about when I got there. I had spent 5 years mm-hmm. in a Chinese church. For those of you that don't know, Ames, Iowa has, I think, the highest population of Asians, not Asian Americans, Asian people in general.
Like first generation.
First generation, second generation, whether or not they're American citizens. I mean, and that's pretty common with any university city, especially mm-hmm. if you're a larger university. But Iowa State brings in a lot of people of color in general. And so, you know, as you're hiring, look for somebody who has experience in the cultures that you're surrounded in. That's going to be an important part of what you're doing. And so we're going to switch into, you know, what does it mean to lead a multicultural church a little bit? And we've kind of done that with what Jason's talking about. But if you're trying to reach a specific culture or a specific group, it is going to be extremely important to have somebody from that culture, preferably multiple people from that culture, on your leadership team. Because no matter what you learn from a book or from interacting with people in the culture for a couple of years, you will not understand it as well as somebody who has lived that culture their entire life. So, for instance, okay, this is why missions work is so difficult. I spent 3 months in Ireland and 3 months in Germany, and Germany was very difficult for me. I had spent 4 years learning German culture and language in high school. I spent another year-ish learning German culture my sophomore year because my wife and I thought we were going to go to Germany full-time after we graduated. And then we got there, and living in that culture is exhausting. Living in a culture that is not your primary culture, or even one that you've adopted at this point, is exhausting on your brain, on your body, on everything. And so having somebody who lives that culture every day is going to be one of the best things you can do to help out with that. If you are a church that is trying to reach the Black people around you, right? Then maybe start asking them what they're looking for in a church. If you are somebody who is trying to reach teenagers in your church, maybe start asking teenagers what they want to see in the church. Because chances are, it is not super unbiblical what they're looking for. And I say super because, of course, sometimes, you know, people are going to say something that's just way out there.
Yeah, but I mean, that's going to happen with any... That is a truly an interracial thing about the church, is everyone, every group of people probably wants something that does not align well with scripture, and they have to grow past that. That Absolutely. Happens.
So that's kind of my thoughts after reading this, especially the section on multicultural churches and seeing the leadership of that.
Gotcha. So this isn't something on the list, but something that comes up a lot when you talk about race relations in the United States, you always have the tragedies, especially they've been highlighted over the last couple of years, but have been happening for decades. Usually the death of a young Black male in some unjust way, oftentimes in interactions with police officers that become violent. And so these interactions, right? Jacob Blake is the first one off the top of my head that just comes to mind because I have a connection to the city that occurred in. Frequently, we see definitely a polarizing response where on one hand, people are very, very upset, often people of color, but not always just people of color, who are then going to go and protest, post on social media, et cetera, and say something needs to change. And then we see a reaction from certain white communities that is, well, you're being disrespectful to police officers. Well, somehow that person deserved it. Well, the police officers, yeah, they made the wrong call, but there's all these mitigating factors and we should just forgive them, or something like that. And obviously there's tons of people on both sides that are kind of in the middle, but those are the two loudest extremes. I think regardless of what you personally think, you can agree, those are the two loudest voices in the room when these sorts of things happen. Was there anything in your reading or from your experience in multicultural ministry that maybe can help us as Christians to approach those kinds of situations?
So whenever something like that happens, there are always people who are going to say something just way out there. You know, Albert Tate points to George Floyd most commonly. That's the one that I'm most... When you look at George Floyd and the instance that surrounded him, this was 3 years ago at this point. Albert Tate actually has an entire chapter. He writes each chapter like they're a letter, essentially. And he writes one to the bereaved, to the people who are mourning, right? He includes a little section here, and he talks about mugshot Jesus, okay? If you look at the way that Jesus lived his life, what did he do? He broke rules all the time, specifically laws for the Jewish believers, right? He would do miracles on the Sabbath. He would do multiple work on the Sabbath. He talked to people who he wasn't supposed to talk to. He would make contact with people who were unclean and go into the temple soon after, after cleaning that person, by the way, essentially. But when you look at Jesus in light of how we look at people like George Floyd, who lost their lives doing essentially nothing, when you look at Jesus that way, it starts to change how you see George Floyd. There ends up being a line that I want to highlight. He says, "I want to be clear that I have no problem being honest about George Floyd's life. He was not a martyr, nor was he a saint or a savior, but he was loved by the Savior, and for that reason alone, he deserves better." And I think that summarizes how we as Christians ought to respond to this. Because he was loved by Jesus, we ought to respond with mercy and love, and we ought to grieve with his family, not shout about how he deserved it.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. So oftentimes, even if you think that you're sitting in the middle, right, that you're like, well, yeah, the police might have overreacted, but there's all these mitigating factors. Something that I think is lost on us, and on me as well, quite frequently, when tragedy befalls a community that we're not a part of. So if we remove the race element, if there's a shooting in a mosque, if there's a drug overdose in a community that's hours away from ours, if for some reason we hear about, if there's another church scandal, but it's at someone else's church, it's not at our church, is it's easy for us to think about the facts of the situation. So with Jacob Blake in Kenosha, right, the one that I had brought up earlier, he did have a knife. He had been, he was under a restraining order that he was breaking. If I recall correctly, he had a knife on him. So we can point out the facts and be like, well, he put himself in a dangerous situation and the officer felt that that he was in danger. So he didn't deserve to be shot. Now, he did survive that, but was very, very seriously injured and will deal with those injuries for the rest of his life. With the example of George Floyd, well, I heard this constantly. Well, he might not have died if he didn't have drugs in his system. Now, the coroner had never found that conclusive, but even if it were 100% certain that that contributed to his death, so what? We think because we're distant from it, right? We think in terms of facts. Well, if they hadn't, well, if they had just, well, you know, whatever. And very infrequently will we find a situation where the person who ends up being harmed or killed had never done anything wrong. They're just a paragon of virtue. Like the worst thing they ever did was speed. Like, because most people just aren't like that. That's not a realistic standard to hold people to. But because we're distant, we can think in terms of facts and say, well, if they just done things differently, it would have turned out different. So I don't feel that bad for them. That's basically how the conversation boils down. Brian Loritz, in a book that I read a couple of years back called Insider Outsider, he was talking about relationships between white churches and black churches and how we can live together. Very similarly to How We Love Matters by Albert Tate. How we can be a more multicultural, multi-ethnic, and empathetic church. He talks about these levels of communication. I normally hear this in business or in leadership classes, that the lowest level of communication is cliche. Then we take a step up to facts. So cliche, oh, hey, how are you? Oh, I'm good. How are you? Well, your day might be horrible, but you're still going to say you're good because it's a cliche. You're expected to say that, so you just do. You're not actually communicating. A step up is facts. The sky is blue is a fact. No one's going to argue with me except for crazy people. Third is opinions. Well, what I think about the presidential election is those can get heated, but you're still just sharing opinions. The fourth step, the fourth stage, the second deepest level of communication is feelings. And he says when tragedies happen in a community of color, specifically he talks about in the African-American community, that the African-American community will go to that fourth level of communication. This is what this makes me feel. It doesn't mean they're being illogical. Please hear me out. It doesn't mean they're being illogical. They're sharing how they're experiencing the thing that has happened. It's a deeper level of communication. And when you go deeper in communication, you are more open to being hurt by others. That's why we don't go deep very often. If I share my emotions with you and then you reject or belittle them, it hurts. If I share a fact with you and you reject it, then I just think you're dumb and it doesn't really hurt my feelings. But the white community, when we're distant from our black brothers and sisters, we go to the level of facts. We go, well, George Floyd shouldn't have done fentanyl. We'll say, well, Jacob Blake shouldn't have had a knife in his hands. And we miss the feelings that our brothers and sisters are having that, well, this is just another example. Yes, the person's not, they know that person isn't perfect, but they're experiencing that one more time. We've seen a young life extinguished when it probably didn't need to happen. And while we're saying, well, here's all the things they could have done to make this situation go smoother, and maybe they'd still be alive, maybe they'd be uninjured, whatever. Our brothers and sisters in the African-American community or whatever community has been wronged is saying, yeah, but this is just one more time. And it's so close to home and it hurts. And I'm scared. What if this happens to me? What if I do one thing wrong and I end up being injured or I end up being killed because I didn't toe the line perfectly? You see how that's like a different type of communication. And what we have to do as people who I will never be black. I'm as white gets. I'm currently wearing a flannel and I have a giant beard. I'm not only white, but I'm hipster. So I'm the whitest kind of white. And I'm never going to be black. I'm never going to be able to experience it like Albert Tate does, like Brian Lawrence does. But what I can do is surround myself with people, have friends who are not the same ethnicity as me, who can explain to me, or just by their presence. I'm not going to walk up and say, hey, tell me how you're feeling about this. Maybe I will, but I probably won't. But just by being in proximity, I can learn to understand, wow, this is really affecting this person. This is really hurting them. And regardless of how I feel about the situation itself, I can at the very least understand that their feelings, their emotions are being deeply affected by something that is very close to home for them. And I can empathize with them and I can maybe minister to them, not by correcting them, but by being a shoulder to cry on, by being empathetic, by praying for healing, by praying for justice, those sorts of things. But we have to make ourselves communicate at a deeper level to talk about not just the facts of the situation, but the feelings that people are experiencing as a result of them. That really, truly does matter. My wife is a counselor. Believe me, feelings matter. So
I'm glad Martin used the word empathy because that's something I wanted to hit on before we keep going.
Cool, go for it.
I think it was Kara Powell who writes in Three Big Questions That Every or That Change Every Teenager, something along those lines. I don't have the book in front of me. But she writes saying, and this was a quote that really stuck with me, most people are not listened to. And if they are, they are not listened to enough that they confuse being listened to and being loved. So to listen to somebody is to love them, essentially, especially in a generation where nobody wants to see someone else's perspective, where nobody interacts in person. Our communication skills are trash. I mean, our generation is terrible at communicating. And so to listen to somebody is to love them in our cultures, and especially our generations. And so when something like this happens, to dismiss somebody that isn't saying, well, you know, I don't see the issue. That's to say, I don't really care about this. I don't really care about you or how you feel about this. And that's a really big allegation to make when you're also claiming that you love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. So you don't have to get it. You probably never will get it. But you do have to listen. You gotta love people. Martin, we covered a little bit of ground here, talking about empathy, talking about surrounding yourself with people that'll help, talking about what church leadership looks like. Is there any other advice that you draw from this book, from other reading, from your experience, whatever, any other advice that just as a Christian, individually, our listeners can do to build stronger bridges with specifically with other Christians from other ethnicities that they're going to run into, interact with, and have a chance to minister with?
Yeah. When Albert Tate starts this book out, he says, this is a tough conversation. It always has been, and it always will be. But in order for us to get better, we have to come to the table, and we have to stay when we get uncomfortable. So some of us are very comfortable saying, I will come to the table. But as soon as as soon as we start talking about stuff that hits too personal, I'm out. If you start talking about something I do, right, then I'm out. If I'm in the wrong, if I'm uncomfortable, if I'm being convicted, I'm walking away. And the only way that this gets better is for all of us on every side to stay when we're uncomfortable and to work through it. And so he actually includes a chapter. This is one of the things that I thought was really interesting. In his chapter titled Dear Mississippi, he talks about how he was discipled into racism. his church taught him, be cautious around white people. His church, he grew up in a black church, and he tells a story about them wanting to have this guy come in for their men's conference. He was a Christian, and the church says, you know, we don't want to do that. And Albert's dad is one of the leaders, and he's saying, well, why not? And they keep coming up with these really bad answers about why he shouldn't be there. And then finally, one guy stands up and he says, it's because he's white. He can't empathize with us. He can't teach us. He's not one of us. And so he acknowledges this is not a white problem. This is a people problem. And I think that's a really important thing to start with. When you're having these conversations, always remember, this is not just a you problem. This is not just a me problem. This is an all of us problem.
Yeah, that's solid advice. And I know, like earlier when we were talking about like church leadership, that there's a lot of people saying, well, I'm not in leadership in my church. I'm not on staff. I'm not an elder. I don't have any influence. I think in a lot of churches, you probably have more influence than you think if you're involved, if you know your pastor, if you're friends with your elders, and even just broaching the subject and saying, hey, you know, our community's 20% whatever ethnicity and our church is 95% white. Those numbers don't match up. Is there something we can do? Just getting that even in people's heads can be a helpful first step. So a few authors that Martin and I have both had varying levels of interaction with that you guys can look into on social media, as speakers, as writers, that maybe can help you explore this subject a little bit more. Obviously, Albert Tate, prolific speaker. I'm not sure how many books he's written, but you can pick up some of his works. Jamar Tisby is another one that I found valuable on social media. He's a history professor now, but he'll look at this issue also from a Christian point of view. There's Esau McCauley. He is Anglican, does a lot of work on racial reconciliation in the church. So that's a very different perspective because he's not an evangelical. So he can be very valuable. And then Brian Loritz is another one. He's written quite a few books. He's also a pastor, does a lot of work in racial reconciliation. So I would look at those four guys to start off with. And then by reading them, you will find other names.
I want to add in one last book as well. Chan doesn't hit on this very often, but in 2022, he wrote a book titled Until Unity, which deals with the unity of believers. And that's going to
Francis Chan.
Yes.
Cool. Francis Chan, Until Unity.
And that's going to deal with specifically church unity, not necessarily racial unity, but he has a lot of, he does his Francis Chan thing and he does a lot of convicting. And I mean, there's just a lot of things that we don't often think about as Americans that need to be, you know, unified as a church. And so, that's a good one to pick up.
We appreciate you guys sticking with us. If you stuck with us this far, we hope that this is somewhat helpful. We're just two white guys that love Jesus. So maybe not everything we said was super helpful, but I hope that some of it was. Please go check out those authors we recommended and be part of the change. Do it in Jesus's name. And I think that's all I have for you guys today. Thank you so much for joining us. Follow us. Give us a 5-star review. Email us if you got any suggestions for us at realpockettheology@gmail.com. And we'll see you back here next time.